You. Okay, so I want to welcome everybody back to the Incidental Zionists. And over the course of this series, we've been looking at people who have played a very critical, crucial role in modern Jewish history. Let's start over there. And particular in regard to certain aspects of the State of Israel. And we've asked ourselves the big question, would you classify these people as Zionist or not? As a result, we have identified the name Incidental Zionist. So far, in the first two members of our series, we've identified... Oh, look, there I am again. Okay, so we've identified two different individuals, and we've basically recognized the fact that they do take on the status of Zionist in a certain sense. And so with that in mind, I think what I'm going to try to do is switch over to the other computer, and we'll deal with the character of the evening in a minute. Hold on. I have to mute myself, I think. No, I'm going to just do this way. Okay, I'm not going to switch over. I'm going to stay with what I have and not create a problem. Right? And what if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That's my general policy when it comes to these things, especially when my IT guy is not home from school yet. Okay, so... So tonight I want to talk about one of the characters in Jewish history, modern Jewish history, who's probably not given nearly enough credit for the role, the massive role that he plays in modern times. It's incredible. The more I got into this character, the more I realized he touches everything in the last 200 years. He serves as a very major player in regard to the last 2 years, the last 200 years. And I find him fascinating for a lot of reasons. And so with that in mind, let's talk a little this evening about, about the Imre Emes, Rav Avraham Mordechai Alter. Who was the Imre Emes? So the Imre Emes was a fascinating character in Jewish history. He was one of the Ger Rebbes. It's always important to know who the Ger Rebbes are. Because when you deal with the Ger Rebbe, by definition, you are dealing with one of the largest Hasidic groups in modern times. The larger Hasidic groups certainly seem to spread themselves far. And Reuven, one day you and I will get a chance to explore a theory that I'm going to share at the end of this year as to how incidental Zionists incidental anti-Zionists may have led to the split of where people in the different Hasidic roots chose to wind up in the world. Do they choose to stay in Europe and move to America or more concentrate their efforts in Israel? I think this may be a deciding factor. We can bat this around as a theory for us to research one day in the future, okay? But let's talk a little bit about him. So before we get to him, let's talk a little bit about Ger Chasidus. If we talk about Ger Chasidim, we're talking certainly about a group that actually goes back well before Ger. There was a group that grew out of Kutsk. The Kutzker Rebbe is probably Itchy Mordechai Morgenstern, who I have a vague relationship with in my mother's side of the family. So Rabbi Morgenstern, the Kutzker Rebbe was very well known. He was known for his pithy comments, but also had a very strong chassidus. When he passed away, he had changed his style to a certain degree. And the chassidim sort of split apart, looked for, trying to figure out where they wanted to wind up. And a very strong element wound up going ahead and following one of his talmidim, the author of the Chidushei Harim. The Chidushei Harim had a son who did not live very long and unfortunately passed away before the Chidushei Harim did. And that son had a grandson who became famous in the world, not only in the world of Hasidus, but also in the world of Lithuanian Jewish scholarship. And he was the author of the famous work, the Sfas Emes. I remember once talking to one of my Lithuanian rabbeim, and when we were talking about Hasidus or Rebbes, and he said, well, there weren't a tremendous number who were also recognized in the Torah world for their non-Hasidic logic. In other words, the more of the Talmudic style. And he said, I can think of the Avnei Nezer. I said, what about the Sfas Emes? He says, Sfas Emes, I forget sometimes that he was even a chassid, which I found to be a very fascinating statement. So well held was the Sfas Emes. At the same time, when he passed away, his son, Rav Avraham Mordechai Alter. So this is the fourth generation of Gerer Chasidus. His son, who was born in 1866 and was now the third official Ger Rebbe, takes an already growing Chasidus and he turns it into something a lot more, and he flips it on its head. So let's talk a little bit about him first. First of all, the Ger community is pretty close to Warsaw, right? And it was well known in Eastern Europe that whoever controls the area closest to Warsaw, at least as far as Hasidic and the Hasidic community, and certainly the Torah community in general in Eastern Europe, is going to be pretty much in control of the of Jewry in Eastern Europe. After all, Warsaw was a very major city, and whoever is recognized as having the strongest Hasidus in the area, that is the individual and the Hasidus that's going to be controlling all of the small towns and influencing them and the ideals and the thoughts. Well, Ger starts to do that, and the Ger influence spreads all the way around. What the Imre Emes had done, in addition to what his father and grandfather had done, father and great-grandfather had done, is that he turned this international. So instead of just being in the general Eastern European Polish border, right, he really brings this around the world, and he really becomes a major player. So let's start. He's born on the 7th of Teves to the Stas Emes. When he's born, the original founder of Ger Chasidus, the Chidush Arim, was still alive. He was his tzaddik. There were some incredible stories within the Ger community about the fact that he was not a well child, that the tzaddik, you know, sat him down, and basically he improved. There were some interesting histories and lore in the Ger community, if you would get interested in studying the background of the Imre Emes. But here's where the excitement goes. 1881. So we're talking about the boy at 15 years old. The Imre Emes, Rav Avraham Mordechai Alter, gets married. Now, at 15 years old, I wasn't even thinking about girls, much less marriage. And here he is, he's 15, he marries his first wife, Chayareda, and he stays with her for 40 years. She dies in 1921. And she has four kids with him. They become identified based on the fact that among them, they all write books and become leaders in the Ger community. So she had a son, who was known as the Beis Yisrael. She had a son who wrote the work, the Leif Simcha, who was Rav Simcha Bunim. He had two daughters also, right? And in 1924, after his wife had passed away and 3 years had gone by, he actually marries his niece, Fega Mincha. And then he has another child with her, Pinchas Menachem, who also ultimately becomes the Rebbe. So when he passes, when we're going to find the end of the life of the Imre Emes actually passes, and all of his sons that were alive, that were still alive after he passed, each one spends time serving as Ger Rebbe, which is fascinating in and of itself. Now, Fega Mincha, just while we're talking about her, while Ger Chasidim, and when you think about them today, they're very set. There are rules about everything in Ger. Well, Fega Mincha, she's not your typical Rebbetzin at all. For starters, they all note that she speaks French, which is a very big no-no in the Ger community, which means she had to have been educated. Remember, French is a Western European language. Here she is in the Eastern Europe. She spoke French. She was known to go out in a shapel. Now, for us, that's a sign of piety, but in the Hasidic community, oh no, no shetel without a spitzel, right? So she was a little bit more, how you should say, even at home, she was a little bit more progressive, and that's not just in terms of her car insurance, right? She was well identified, and it reflects a certain idea about the Imre Emes himself and exactly how he put things together. Now, going back to the beginning of his marriage to his first wife, to Chayareda, he initially lives with his father-in-law for the first number of years of his marriage, and he gets told by his father, listen, your job is just to learn Torah, and don't spend too much time on trivialities. But his father also says to him, while you're living with your father-in-law, I still want you to be able to be involved with the people. So you can't just sit alone in your room all day learning Torah. You have to go to the Hasidic Shtibel. You can't go ahead and just be a separatist. And so after spending a bit of time in Biala, where he was basically living with his father-in-law about 3-4 years. He picks up and he moves to be near his father. And for 22 years, he's his father's primary attendant, right? That is to say, he's his father's right-hand man. And he learns from him how a Rebbe is supposed to conduct himself in day-to-day activities. At the same time, it should be noted that he was quite a bibliograph. And it stayed that way throughout his life. He was very interested in Sfarim. He used to converse with all the great leading Torah luminaries. Some people, in order to sort of stick it to the MRMS, they say, well, he's so busy, he can't even write a halachic piece. And sure enough, he points out that, he has, even though he was known to have an incredibly large and extensive library, half of which was, most of which was destroyed in World War II, he said that there was no sefer that he owned that he didn't go through thoroughly. And that includes from Sfardi Gedolim, which, you remember, you're dealing with an Eastern European, how he came to appreciate Sfardic Psag and get a hold of Sfardic Sfarim was a statement on how he thought globally and how was in his mind he was sort of a global individual. They say that he went to the National Library of Israel, or its precursor, actually. And he walked in and he asked to check a couple of things. And so they say that when he checked, he pointed out that there were quite a few mistakes in the manuscript. And he pointed out that they were there. This is this. It's not correct. And if you go back and look at the original, you'll see that it's incorrect. And the librarians went back, checked on him, and sure enough, he was right. So such an expertise, such a bibliograph. But when his father dies in 1905, he steps up to the plate. Now he's going to replace his father as Rebbe. Initially, like a good chassid, he makes the decision and he refuses. But then comes Shavua. Shavua is going to be an important thing for the Imre Emes. We'll see in his beginning of his life, and at the end of his life, Shavua becomes important. So in 1905, in Shavua, he conducts a tish. And until that point in time, there was some controversy as to who would take over. And his brother-in-law gets up and says, when the Sfas Emes was very, very sick, the Imre Emes went in to see him. And when the Imre Emes walked in, there was a chair in the room. And said, the brother-in-law says, we're both in the room. And the Sfas Emes points to the chair and he tells the Imre Emes, you sit. And when he knew that the Sfas Emes never said any extra words, so that must meant, says this brother-in-law about his brother-in-law, our subject tonight, he says he never said anything extra, so when he said shave, sit, he must have meant sit on the throne. Now, last week, we all were very involved in the thrones, in a Game of Thrones in England, right? Well, so the Game of Thrones in Gerach Hasidus became a pretty clear understanding. And so the Imre Emes is sort of coronated on Shavuos 1905, and he makes it, and he is now the new Rebbe of the Gerach Hasidus. And immediately he turns around and flips everything about Gerach on its head. It is well known that one of the major claims against Hasidim in general is their stress of spirituality over halacha. So when there's a conflict, for instance, between Zman Kriya Shema, or davening on time, and davening with the proper preparations. Since the dawn of Hasidus, it was always assumed that Hasidim should choose to make sure that they daven properly in terms of spirit instead of properly in terms of practice. Well, the Gerebi says, I don't see, our friend the Imre Emes turns around and he says, I think that's ridiculous. And so immediately he says, I'm going to change the spirituality qualities here in Ger. And so one of the first things he does is he changes the Tefillah and the Avodas Hashem style. He establishes the idea that in Ger, from now on, davening will be on time. By the way, this holds true until today. You meet a Ger Chassid, he davens on time. And so throughout the Ger world, they davened at 7:30 every single day. So the older Hasidim came over to complain, which is very common in Hasidic world. That's not the way your father told it to us. I got that, you don't have to be a Hasid to hear that speech. Right? You could just be a new rabbi in town and just get told that the older rabbi never insisted on these things. But I digress and go off my point. So he gets challenged, And he tells the Hasidim, this is the way it's going to be. So the older Hasidim said, well, wait a second. What about the fact that we were supposed to learn in the morning, right? Before davening, how could you daven without starting off with learning? And so he says, you know what? He says, if things were supposed to be the way that the Sfas Emes says that they're supposed to be, then the Sfas Emes would still be alive. Hey, I'm new in town. I'm here to carry the mission of my father forward, but it's going to be with a new flavor and a new understanding. And as for learning, he says, well, on Friday nights, we're going to have learning between Kabbalah, Shabbos, and Maariv, and they did in Ger. And on Shabbos, yeah, we'll daven on time. And if you're so worried, right? So here's what we're going to do from now on. Before laning, we're going to shut everything down, and everyone sits down and learns. And he establishes this idea of the fact that everybody, not just the students in the yeshiva, everybody has a daily Gemara shir. And he establishes that. And he says, if you're not capable enough to handle the Gemara shir, which was a issue for a lot of people, he says, at least you'll be able to have a Perek of Mishnayos. So that this way, during those community siddurim, when the people are walking around during those community programmed learning times, he said no one would be able to be walking around during the learning time. We know that he was the number one catalyst for the Daf Yomi movement. What does that mean? We know that the one who established the Daf Yomi movement was the Lublina Rav, Rav Meir Shapiro, right? He was the one who came in and had the idea. But before that idea came to fruition, Rav Meir Shapiro went to meet with two individuals. The Chafetz Chaim, who represented Litvish non-Hasidic Jewry, and was the oldest member of the rabbinate at the time. He was the recognized Gadol Hador. And then the Gerer Rebbe, the Imre Emes, our character. Why is that? Because he knew that if he had their support, it would carry. So sure enough, what happens, the Chafetz Chaim, when he hears the idea, he tells Rav Meir Shapiro, you're great. It's a great idea. He says, but you also have to understand, you're young, and that's not going to work. So we're going to have this big Knessia Gedola. We're going to have this big gathering of all different Torah luminaries. And here's what I want you to do. At the big meeting, I want you to walk in 15 minutes late. So Rav Meir Shapiro walks in 15 minutes late, and the Chafetz Chaim stands up for him. And as soon as the Chafetz Chaim stands up, well, everyone else stands up. And the Chafetz Chaim says, I'm standing up for the idea that this individual has. And so Rav Meir Shapiro passes the idea forward, and sure enough, that's half of how Daf Yomi was born. The other half of the story is that year on Rosh Hashanah, which is a couple of weeks later, and the official kickoff date for Daf Yomi, by the way, and the first night of Rosh Hashanah, the Rebbe stops his Rosh Hashanah tish and he says, okay, I'm done. And the Hasidim say, what? He says, yeah, I got to go learn the first daf. It's Daf Yomi. Got to learn the first daf. Immediately throughout the Gerer community, all the 200,000 Hasidim who had come to spend Rosh Hashanah with their Rebbe, there was not a Gemara Brachos to be found. And everybody adopted it. And once Ger adopted it, it started to spread all over Eastern Europe. And once that was the case, so although he can't get the credit for being the one who established the idea, he's not. But you see the power of the influence that the Imre Emes has, and therefore he serves as the catalyst. 200,000 people in Eastern Europe considered him their Rebbe. And he used to have a comment, he writes in one of his farm, he says, you know, the best muster saver in life is the clock or the watch. When he meets with people, if you thought Rav Chaim Kanievsky was short with buha, he had nothing. He kept meetings and greetings and everything very short. Why? Because he wanted to go on with life. But he was also one of the first rabbis in his life and in the lifetime who saw the importance of reaching out to the younger Hasidim as a separate element. Until that point, Hasidus was really like, it was a trickle down. There was the Rebbe, there was his inner circle of older Hasidim, there were all the older Hasidim, and like you aspired to get to be old enough to hang out with the Rebbe. But he turns around and he says, you know, there's a big problem going on here in Europe. And what's that? He sees, you know, the younger people, they're being very influenced by other ideas, socialism, secular Zionism, other sorts of isms that were flying around in Europe at the time. And he says, I got to counter the culture. And so he says, you know what? I've got to establish a personal relationship with the younger chevra. They have to know that they don't have to work, you know, to get up to me by spending, you know, 30 years waiting for the chance. And so he establishes a yeshiva called the Darchei Noam Yeshiva. In fact, young people are known, and we get accused of this a lot, although I'm in a transition apparently. But, you know, there's a certain language that the older people like to use around the younger people. Alan Dershowitz made it famous in English, but it's called chutzpah, right? If you don't like the way the younger people are dealing with it, chutzpah, right? And that big word, it comes out. So the Imri Emes decides that he's going to rebrand that idea. And he decides, and he writes this in one of his Ma'amarim in Purim, he says, from now on, we're not going to go call what the young people are doing against the establishment, and we're not going to call it chutzpah, that's a pejorative. From now on, we're going to refer to it as Azus de Kedusha. Azus is a brazenness of holiness, right? Amalek, that was chutzpah, right? Because that's what Purim's all about. It says, what they did was chutzpah. The opposite is not non-chutzpah and conciliation. The opposite is Azus de Kedusha, having a backbone, but to do it for holy purposes. It's ingenious. It's a rebranding. And the Imri Emes, as you can see so far, he's a master at branding. In addition to his piety and his tzidkus, he's a master brander. Now, there, he was not a man who everyone just rolled over and played dead for. There was a long-standing feud during his rabbinate between two sects of Hasidus, between the Gerer Rebbes and the Alexander Rebbes, from Alexander, like Rav Hanachanach of Alexander and others. And the big issues came up over the who had control over some of the bigger influence cities. The rabbinate in Lodz, L-O-D-Z, right, was actually one of the major flashpoints. And he solved it by sort of paying off the situation so that the Alexander Rebbe felt better about the situation. And as a result, he becomes known as the Rockefeller of the Rebbes. He was the Hasidic Rockefeller. And even in Lithuanian circles, he maintains a relationship with the Avnei Nezer, with others, and he becomes known even in the Lithuanian circles as a person to deal with and talk to and respect. In fact, they say the Sachachev Rebbe, the Avnei Nezer, said he carried himself to Imre Emes as a Melech Yisrael, as a Jewish king. And that's how he becomes known as the Rockefeller of the Rebbes. Now, very uncharacteristic of Rebbes until that time, he was a pretty political person. Yeah, what does that mean? He understood the politics of the day. He tried, and his goal in running things was he always wanted to be the guy in the middle. And that was the guy who stood there like with the white gloves trying to like police the traffic and to stave off the machlokas. But he was also one of the Rebbes who saw the value of a very strong Agudas Yisrael, right? Now, the Chafetz Chaim and the other Litvish Rosh Hashivas, they saw Aguda as an environment for shuls, for building schools and mikvos. He saw it for a lot more. He saw it as a vehicle for people to sort of unite and be a chance for a lot of Jewry to actually be recognized as a force to be reckoned with throughout Europe, because the Aguda will be there. And religious Aguda was supposed to be there with a certain strength. And so he then becomes known also with some people who didn't really appreciate that. They started to say, well, Agudas Yisrael is not Agudas Yisrael, it's Agudas Hagur, right? And certainly, even in Israel till today, it should be understood, even in the political scheme of things, one of the things that people will tell you is, if you study the Aguda branch in Israel, it is very much influenced by the where the Gerer Rebbe goes, that's where things go, for the most part. Last week we mentioned the Imri Emes for a different reason. Whereas it would be very clear that Hasidish Rebbes would probably see no value in having a newspaper. But as we remember from last week, we were talking about Reb Zevin, we mentioned that the Imri Emes was very pro trying to establish a newspaper, a Haredi daily, something that would be kosher. Now, he wasn't pro the newspaper, he was pro the idea that people need to have outlets. And if we can have a positive outlet, then we should do that. Unfortunately, World War I swallowed up that idea. He did not make money off being a Rebbe. And this is going to be important for us when we start to realize that how he operated. He did business. He worked in business. And the reason he did that is he didn't want to be beholden to anybody else's money or to be beholden to other people. And therefore, by definition, he was a mover and a shaker and a force to be reckoned with. Most Rebbes made money and continue to make money in modern time by having control of institutions and having chassidim who give pidyonos, which is the, you know, so to speak, like major donations so that the Rebbe gives them a bracha, etc. Not the Imre Emes. He says what he feels like, and he does what he feels like, because he feels that's the best way to go. Well, during World War I, he had to move out of Ger. He winds up running to Warsaw, but then later, he goes back to Ger. And he travels to Israel 5 times, which we'll get back to. But after World War I, he travels in 21, 24, 27, 1932, and 1935. We'll get back to the point of each of these visits, but just to know, he's doing all this between World War I and World War II. He thought about staying on the fifth try. And he said, unfortunately, he was told by the European Rabbanim, the Beis Din in Ger, that he had to return home in order to shepherd his flock. Right? And when the Nazis come to Warsaw in 39, the first thing that they do is they're trying to round up the rabbis. Right? What can we do? And the first rabbi they went after was the Imre Emes. They are looking for the Wunderrabbi, right? Wie is the Wunderrabbi? They want to know where the Wonder Rabbi is. Well, the Hasidim actually spirited him out. And by moving him, they stayed one step ahead of the Nazis. And they move him throughout the ghetto. And then eventually they get him out of the ghetto and into Italy. Unfortunately, at that point in time, other than the 3 children that were traveling with him, the rest of his family is murdered. And he never sees them again. Some say, though, that when he made it to Italy, Mussolini himself got involved with protecting the Imre Emes, arguing, according to the lore in Ger, that the Pope of the Jews has to make it to Israel, the same way that the Pope in Italy would also have to be saved. In 1940, the Imre Emes does make it to Israel. And he settles in Israel. And in 1943, with the war in full fledge, the chief rabbi of Israel at the time, Rav Herzog, called for a community fast day. And who's out there at the photos together with the Rav Herzog in support of this united effort in Israel? The Imre Emes. The zealots in Yerushalayim, they don't participate. They stay away. So it tells you again, the Imre Emes is not a classic. He marches to his own beat. He rebuilds a Hasidus in Israel that got destroyed throughout Europe. He wound up quite subdued, though, because in the process, he was both physically old at the time and mentally. You can't imagine that the experience of losing your entire family or huge chunks of the family is easy. And he continues to do his thing. He rebuilds. He keeps working. And in 1948, in the middle of the Milchemet HaShechrur, in the middle of the War of Independence in Israel, he died. In fact, he was supposed to be buried on Har HaZeitim, but it was determined to be not safe for Jews to be able to go from one place to another. And so they decided they were going to temporarily bury him on Har HaZeitim, in the courtyard of the yeshiva, which is in the Geula area. And eventually they'll move him to Har HaZeitim. Eventually has not come yet. So if you want to go to the kever of the Imre Emes, you will find him buried in the courtyard of the Sfas Emes Yeshiva in Geula. At this point, he's flanked by his sons. Let's talk about his Zionism, because after all, this is a nice sketch of an unbelievable individual who had his hand in everything. But this is a class where we're trying to figure out, is this man an incidental Zionist? Is he a Zionist? Is he an anti-Zionist? Well, let's first talk about Ger philosophy. So the Sfas Emes says, look, you have to understand, the Sfas Emes writes in his writings that Israel, he sees the Eretz Yisrael as a harbinger of spiritual opportunity. But the Sfas Emes, this is the Imre Emes's father, was very opposed to secular Zionism, and he was also opposed to capturing the land. The Imre Emes officially doesn't stray from his father's opinion. And he spends a lot of time, and he writes about this in 1915, right, of trying to find truth in Galus. That he says it's possible to find Emes in Galus, and that's the Jew's responsibility while he's in Galus. He doesn't really speak about our responsibility to Tolichenu Kom Miyut Le'artzenu, to go upright quickly to Israel. But yet, when the idea comes up on a practical level in 1937, when the partition plan comes up, the Aguda Convention happens, and there was debate, do we support this, do we not support the partition plan? And they're debating it left and right, and he walks into the meeting, and he looks at everyone, and he says, quotes a pasuk in Yoel, Perek Dalet, pasuk Beis, and he says, you can't have a divided land. It's all. We have a responsibility for all. And so that was the end of the meeting, because everyone turns around and says, where the Emre Emes goes, that's where we go. And he takes a very strong position in favor of the land. Yet, when it comes to the statements on Zionism, he doesn't come out very pro-Zionists. You know what he does come out in favor of? Parallelism. He's very pro having Yishuv Haaretz, which in my book is Zionism, right? Settling the land. But he says the settlement of the land has to be al pi derech haTorah. It has to be based on Torah principles. And as I mentioned to you before, he visits Israel in 21, 24, 27, 32, and 35. What I didn't tell you was every time he came, he brought an entourage with him, and he has them go ahead and settle in Israel. When Christa Korn comes along, he turns around and he says, he goes to visit the Imre Emes, and he says, I have this little piece of land outside of Lod. I'd like to build it up. It's going to be called Bnei Brak. And so he turns around and tells Christa Korn, hey, I want to get in on that, right? And he encourages his Hasidim, go live in Bnei Brak. And guess what you can find until today in Bnei Brak? A very strong Gerer contingent. In fact, if I had to pick the most anti-Zionistic rabbi of the era from World War II till, say, 2023, the name that is most associated with anti-Zionism would be Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, the Satmar Rebbe. Agreed? I'm getting a yes out of both Dr. Wenger and Reuven Blau, so I think that we would all say, based on the way we've been brought up. Well, before the Satmar Rebbe left Satmar, the Rebbes used to get together in the summer in a town called Marienbad, right? And they would go to relax over the summer and recharge batteries. So the Imre Emes finds himself in Marienbad, and the Satmar Rebbe's there, and the Satmar Rebbe comes running up to the Imre Emes, and he starts screaming at him, don't you know that in Israel there are Machal al Shabbos? And how do you go ahead and send your Hasidim to live there? You're going to cause such a desecration of Shabbos. And of course, the Imre Emes leans over to his son and he says, this bacher, which is a complete and total insult, right? This young man, Reb Yolish, is currently speaking against Eretz Yisrael. I don't speak to people who speak against Eretz Yisrael. End, set, match. In fact, in 1945, when the Satmar Rebbe came to visit him, he still wouldn't talk to him. So if you look at the histories, both from Satmar and Ger, you will hear two different versions as to why in 45 he didn't speak to him. In Satmar, they say that the Imre Emes was too old at that point. And that's why, although the Rebbe, Satmar Rebbe, came to visit, he had what they call the fruit tish, right? But he was too old, so there was no real conversation. On the other hand, in Ger, they say, he said he wouldn't speak to him because he spoke badly about Eretz Yisrael. And there's a bit of information that I bet, Reuven, I bet you didn't expect to hear. Right? He, after one of his trips to Israel, on his way back, he writes a famous letter that I had a chance to view thanks to a shiur that was given many years ago by Rabbi Bravender. And he wrote a famous letter called Al HaSvina. It was the letter he wrote on the boat. And he tells the people, I'm leaving Israel now. I've met with so many wonderful people. I've even met with a British high commander, so it's obviously before 48, Herbert Samuels. I met with Rav Kook, who obviously was not very close with, you know, some of the zealots who were out to get them. I see the Rabbi Sonnenfeld, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, who I spent time with. He says, there is a very strong possibility for people to live in Israel. And you can come and live in Israel. And at the very least, if you, for whatever reason, don't choose to live in Israel, you should support Israel. And he says, he, according to the history, he made it his business to stop the battles between zealots and Rav Kook. He sees the mass aliyah of Hasidim in the 20s, right? And he sees it as an opportunity, and he makes it very clear. And he doesn't only talk the talk and write the writing. He takes out money, and he starts investing all over this area near the port in Haifa. There was this little city there called, Tel Aviv. Maybe you've heard of it. And then there's an exclusive area in the north, which is now known today as Tzfon Tel Aviv. Shu'afat, there's a whole bunch of areas over there. This is where the bourgeoisie of modern Israeli society lives. Dr. Wenger, tell them I'm correct. Who owns the land that all the bourgeoisie of Israel is currently living? Look at the deeds. The Gerer Rebbe, the Gerer Hasidim own all of those fancy schmancy townhouses and all of those fancy schmancy neighborhoods. And they're all going ahead and contributing to the Gerer Rebbe. Why? Because he told people, and he said he would have owned more. And if the people would have only listened to him, how much more would they be able to afford? If you check it out, in Israel, one of the wealthiest one of the most wealthiest institutions on the economic role in Israel, hands down, is the controller of the Gerer Empire, usually identified as the Rebbe. He goes to visit Rav Kook in 1927, and some of the Kanaim start throwing things at him, but he says, look, my goal in life is to calm tensions among Jews. The one place he really had a hard time was, he sits with Rav Kook, and you can read this in Rav Kook's writings here also, he wasn't very pro the secular movement. So my mother likes to point out Karen Kayemet, who is a street not far from her, right? KKL, Karen Kayemet Yisrael, which at the time was how everyone in Europe contributed to Israel. You had pushkas all over the place. And even in the Frum community, people, they connected to Israel by giving money and into the KKL pushkas. So he tells Rav Kook he thinks that there should be a different pushka, and he does. He sets up a separate tzedakah fund to support the people in Israel. All of this is great up until the point in time of the founding of the state. Once the state is founded, he turns around and he says, look, there is no question that whatever it is, now that there's a Medina, it's a good sign. It has to be a good sign. Maybe this is what we call kima kima. This is his writing, I'm quoting, a little bit at a time, umisrabah veholeches. It starts out small and it will grow and grow. I wonder what would happen if he would be walking around in Israel to see the beautiful growth that exists bizman hazeh from kima v'kima. The only thing that's fascinating is he doesn't see any problems with the Arabs in the land, because wherever he goes, they fall and bow to his feet. They recognize that he's otherworldly. And so they're amazed by him. In 35, on his last trip before he makes Aliyah, he goes to Hebron. And in Hebron, at that point in time, next Shabbos is Yom Hebron. In 1967, the Six-Day War took place. On the third day of the war, Yerushalayim was united. And that's why on Friday we celebrate, on the 28th day of Iyar, we celebrate Yom Yerushalayim. And then the day after, Rav Goren got into a jeep, and he traveled all the way down to Hebron. and without firing a shot, without a weapon, because he was a chaplain, didn't travel with a weapon, right? He captured the city of Hebron. The Arabs just turned in. So it's quite timely, proving that even these historical series are, as we say, Dr. Wenger, all connected, right? So in 1935, he goes down, he goes there. Now, if you went to Israel and you traveled to Hebron, I would say the number one site that you're traveling to is the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, the Cave of the Patriarchs. I was in Israel very, very briefly in March. And I spoke to my daughter. We were going to see what we wanted to do. But I said, look, if I'm going to see my mom and I'm going to visit my dad's kever, I need to go see the grandparents as well. And we went. We went to, and my daughter was very excited, we went to Hebron. And at that point in time, it was a relatively calm day. The days before were a little bit more wild. But the one thing she wanted to do very badly was go to Ma'arat HaMachpelah. All right? So in it's all built up today. You can have a whole entrance. Granted that, unfortunately, you can't go everywhere all the time, but it's all built up. If you went in 1935, all you got to see is what my father-in-law calls the steps that he used to get to hang out by. My father-in-law is a Kohen, and he can't go into the Cave of the Patriarchs, right? So he had to wait outside in what today is the Kohen spot. The Kohen spot has steps that go all the way down to the actual cave. Right, since it's outside, there's no problem with the Kohen being there. In 1935, Jews were only allowed to go down 7 steps. And the British were very strict about this, and they were very wild about it because they were afraid that the Arabs were going to riot. And so if a Jew went past the 7th step, the British officers would stand there and arrest you. So the Imre Emes comes down, and he starts walking to the 7th step, and the British officer stops him. So he says, I understand. Any single guy who drives a camel that brought us here is able to go down further. I'm paying the fare, and I don't get to go down as far as he? That makes no sense. I'm the Melech Yisrael, right? And so the officer says, I thought he was the Jewish king. I let him go down to the 11th step. So so recognized was he by secular people. He just carried that air about him. And after he got the 11th step, some of the entourage came down with him, and a bunch of them got arrested. No one had tried to go past the 7th step. It wasn't just that this was official. Nobody ever challenged until the Imre Emes came along. The Imre Emes challenged people's thinking. He challenged their ideas. He tried to bring Jewry together, but he always felt it had to be al derech haTorah. He felt that, in my opinion, I think, is he an incidental Zionist? Well, his love of Israel is certainly beyond fact. Would you say that he's incidental? It's hard to believe he's not a Zionist. He owns a good chunk of the most expensive parts of Israel. He was a Zionist before it was Zionistically in and attractive to be a Zionist. Would he allow me to call him a Zionist? He'd probably throw rocks at me because he felt that the isms were not important. He saw himself as an individual who was here to lead Jewish people together back to their relationship with Avinu Shebashamayim, with their Father in with our Father in Heaven, no matter where we are, and that we should develop a relationship with one another respectfully, one nation under God, indivisible. He was an incredible person. He was a uniter. He was a force. He was a leader. And it's our sincerest hope that his memory serves as a blessing, and that some of the infighting and gear today that hits the news today would be things that would bother him tremendously, and hopefully it stops and brings us all back to where we need to be, united as a nation together. Anybody want to add anything? Okay, so Be'ezrat Hashem next week, our final session, probably the most interesting insofar as never is the question incidental Zionist so debated and so opposed as the Hungarian rabbi we're going to meet next week, Rav Akiva Schlesinger, who is an individual who they had our question, incidental Zionist, was the subject of a full day of debate in Israel and Yerushalayim about 10 years ago, which I only discovered after I put him on the list. And so Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll figure out how Hungarians do it. So far, a Rosh Hashiva, a Chabad rabbi, tonight a Hasidic rebbe, Next week, a Hungarian Rav. Zionism can be found everywhere. All we need to do is unite underneath it. A wonderful Shabbos to everybody.
Thank you.
Kol tov.